So for people who are new to this course, just a sort of reminder that we're looking at Buddhism through symbols and stories. That's the sort of theme of this course, which can be a more direct way of communicating what the Dharma's really about than using words and concepts, although we will use words and concepts because it's difficult to talk otherwise, really. But we'll be introducing the words and concepts as well, but we'll be using the medium of symbols and stories. And we've done a few things with that, but at the moment what we're doing is we're looking at symbols and stories which, if you like, illustrate Sangharakshita's system of meditation. So Sangharakshita's laid this out as a system of meditation, but it's also, it's a bit more than just a system of meditation. It's a sort of roadmap to the spiritual life, if you like. It's a system of spiritual development, not just a system of meditation. Which has these four sort of stages, if you like: integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, and spiritual rebirth. So in a way, it's looking at how we, the first two, integration and positive emotion, in a way are about how we build a happy, healthy, ethical self. And then the last two, spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, are, if you like, the way that we transcend that self, the way that we sort of use that self as a springboard to become to something more universal, if you like. So we're currently looking at stories, symbols that have to do with integration. And in fact, we've got quite a few weeks on that, I think, because it's quite a big topic. So just very briefly, what on earth do we mean by integration? The fact is that we don't start out life, or perhaps even necessarily finish life, as a unified being whose energies and desires are all harmonized. It's a bit more as though we're a bundle of different people, rather loosely tied together by a name and having to share the same body and history. Our energies aren't united, so they don't all run in the same direction. And we need, you know, our first job in a way is to pull ourselves together, to become a bit more of a united being, both by sort of horizontal integration, if you like, what's called horizontal integration, which is, there might be almost like different parts of ourselves that have got different goals. One of us wants to be a rock star, another one wants to be a businessman, another one wants to just have a good time, and, you know, we need to sort of bring those together. So horizontal, because they're all sort of on the same level. But also vertical integration. We don't just exist on the mundane level. We've got heights and depths, and we need to bring those in as well. We need to be a full, whole, potent individual. We need to integrate those as well. Deep energies. There are deep energies we need to integrate. Even perhaps rather crude energies that we need to integrate. And also we need to integrate our heights. We need to be in touch with our sense of ourselves as a higher being, our higher states of mind. We need the guidance, if you like, of our higher self, which is also the key to horizontal integration, because when we've got something in our life which is meaningful, then it's what brings the sort of different aspects of ourselves together. So integration along with positive emotion is really the starting point. It is the starting point of the spiritual life. We need to build this healthy, harmonious self as our starting point. And only then do we think of transcending it. So a big part of this integration is establishing a sort of sound ethical foundation for our practice as the basis for our progress in meditation. That's an important part of our integration, if you like. We integrate around, if you like, our core principles. We walk our talk. We become a being of one piece, acting on our principles. That's what it means to be ethical. So we don't have one set of principles, but then we act in a completely other way. So establishing this this sound ethical foundation involves working on our old habits and tendencies, our habitual habits and tendencies that get in the way. Because unless we do something about it, we may have all the principles in the world, but we will just act the way we usually act in our body, our speech and our mind, we'll just carry on habitually. So we need to start working on those habitual ways, that habitual self. And to start working on it, we need to own up to it. We need to own up to who we really are. We need to recognise our habits of body, speech and mind. And we're really resistant to doing that. What we really like to think that we're... we don't want to do that. We really like to think we're really quite advanced. So, for example, we think, ill will, I don't do ill will. I don't really do ill will. We don't recognise that sort of bit of irritation when somebody we don't particularly like gets a promotion or something good happens to them, that's ill will. Or that sort of sense that, that desire that somebody really gets in our way should get their comeuppance. We don't recognise that's ill will. We don't recognise that little gladness that something didn't quite work out for them. That's ill will. Those sorts of things, that competitiveness, all of that, we don't recognise that. It's there in our mind, but very often I'm a really nice person. No, I'm a really nice person. If we had, it would be different, wouldn't it, if we had a loudspeaker on top of our head that announced to the whole world exactly what we were thinking at any moment in time. That would help our integration enormously, because it would go, I'm a nice person, I'm a nice person. Oh, and did you hear so-and-so got that job? Oh, bugger it, etc., etc. Then we'd have to own up to it. We'd have to own up. We'd know, we and everybody else would know exactly who we really are. But we don't do that. We somehow don't recognise those thoughts as ill will, or we don't recognise... our craving as craving. We don't recognise our fears as fears. We don't, it's sort of, for now, I'm really quite sorted. I'm really quite sorted. I don't have those thoughts. Last week, the story that we looked at last week pointed out the need for openness and honesty, including honesty with ourselves. So we saw a tragic story about somebody who kept a false log. And we saw that we keep a false log. We try to fool ourselves and others. We try and fool others, and we end up fooling ourselves. And this week we're going to look at another story. We're going to look at a story that's about putting our unskillfulness out there, seeing all the unskillfulness in the world, rather than seeing our part of it. So the first stage in this integration is starting to see and owning up to ourselves as we are, warts and all. There's a joke, isn't there? I really apologise beforehand to anyone of Irish extraction, and I have got some Irish ancestry, okay? There's this story, isn't there, about somebody in Ireland who starts to ask the way to somewhere, and this guy says, well, if I was going there, I wouldn't start from here. Well, that's our attitude, isn't it? If I was going to enlightenment, I wouldn't start from here, where I am now. There's a woman called Pema Chodron wrote a book called Start Where You Are. I don't know whether it's actually a good book or not, but it's a good title, isn't it? Because if we don't start where we are, we're not going to get where we're going. It's simple. If we don't start where we are, our spiritual life will be a daydream. We won't be dealing with the things we really need to deal with. We'll be following the spiritual life as though we were this other wonderful being. It's heavenly music. We'll be following the spiritual life as though we were this other wonderful being who didn't have these things to work on before they get anywhere. So, as I said, last week we looked at one way of not owning up to who we are, which is dishonesty. This week we'll look at another way, which is seeing it always as out there. So seeing all the unskillfulness in the world as others and not owning our part of it. Yeah? And this is the story of the Lambton Worm. So has anyone heard of the story of the Lambton Worm? How many people from... Yeah, okay, there's a few people. From Sunderland? Any Sunderland connections? It's near Sunderland, yeah. It's a northeastern story, isn't it? And it's a true story. It's a true story. I mean, those of us that know Sunderland have seen the hill that the worm used to wrap itself around, and it's got a it's got the Lambton Monument on top. So it's a true story, in more ways than one, as everyone with a link to Sunderland knows. So in the story, we're in the Middle Ages. It's the time of the Crusades in the Middle Ages, I suppose, early Middle Ages. And the story is, there's a longer story, but it's summarised in a song, which has got quite a lot of humour in it. The song is good fun, actually. So the song starts with a call for our attention. I'm not going to do the accent. Somebody else can do the accent. Which starts something like, "Wish lads, add yez gobs, I'll tell yez all an awful story. Wish lads, add yez gobs, I'll tell ye about the worm." Which translated means, I say, can I have some quiet, please, chaps? And I'll relate a horrible history to you. If I could just have your attention for a moment, I'll tell you about the worm, or the dragon. Then it goes on, "One Sunday morn, Lord Lambton went a-fishing in the weir." So, in the language of the Middle Ages, this little line tells us a lot. Lord Lambton went fishing when all decent blokes, all decent citizens should be at church on Sunday morning. Okay. The story sort of is much more explicit about this, much more explicit, that young Lord Lambton was a bit of a self-centred, irresponsible individual who didn't care about his duties as a lord to the wider community much. He didn't care much for others. He didn't care much about anything remotely ethical or certainly not spiritual. He was mainly interested in himself and having a good time. That's the sort of character sketch of young Lord Lambton. So in the language of the Middle Ages, this could be summed up by the fact that he wasn't in church. He was fishing in the weir. Bad karma, Middle Age style. So he's fishing in the weir. One Sunday morning, Lord Lambton went a-fishing in the weir. He caught a fish upon his hook he thought looked very queer. So fishing. I mean, fishing is a bit of a universal symbol for plumbing the depths, isn't it? I mean, you can't see what's down there. You put a hook in and something comes out. For bringing things, plumbing the depths of the unconscious, bringing things that were hidden in the dark into the light. And then fish are pretty weird things anyway. So at the level of the story, if you like, well, Lord Lambton caught a strange fish. He didn't like the look of it at all. At the symbolic level, maybe he got a hint of something about himself that he's not usually conscious of. Something that had been in the depths of his unconscious. And he had a bit of a look at it. He maybe got a glimmer of the fact that maybe he got a glimmer of the fact that he didn't really care much about anybody else. I don't know what his motivations were. That his privileged position had made him a rather spoilt, selfish person. Just the merest hint, maybe, he got of seeing this. He didn't like it. He didn't like the look of the fish that he'd hauled out of the depths. One little bit. This little fish didn't like the look of it. So the story goes on, or the song goes on. But what a kind of fish it was, Lord Lambton couldn't tell. But he couldn't be fashed, that's northeastern, couldn't be bothered, couldn't be fashed to carry it home, so he hoyed it down the well. So he's got this fish, doesn't like the look of it at all, brought something up from his own depths, if you like, doesn't like the look of it. This unwelcome insight, perhaps, into his own motives or whatever, didn't like the look of it, didn't want to deal with it, got rid of it, put it back down out of sight, in the depths, out of awareness, forgot about it, refused to deal with it, put it down the well. Okay? Fish, don't like it, down the well. Didn't like this queer fish. So he refused to deal with it. Didn't like the look of it. Not completely unlike most of us, probably most of the time. And then he got on with his life. He got on with his life. And the way he got on with his life is quite revealing. So here we have someone who, in the symbolic language of the song, is refusing to look at their own unskillfulness. He's refusing to look at his own worm, which he's thrown down the well to get out of sight. And what he does instead is he goes off to deal with other people's unskillfulness. He goes off to the Crusades to fight the evil infidels. That is where the evil is, over there. Those other people, they're the unskillful ones, especially those strange other people, they're the unskillful ones. That's where the evil lies. They are the problem in the world. I do not share my part in the problem of the world. I do not have any unskillfulness to deal with, but they do, and I am going to make them deal with it at the point of the sword, if necessary. So he goes off to deal with other people's unskillfulness. He goes off to put the world to rights in the Crusade, and he becomes quite a hero, fighting other people's unskillfulness as he sees it, making them see the error of their ways. But meanwhile, something terrible is happening back home in his own lands, on his own estate. And the song from memory goes something like, "The worm it growed and growed and growed, and growed an awful size, with a great big head, and great big teeth, and great big goggly eyes." I like the humour in the song. So you throw something you don't like about yourself down the well, where you don't have to take any notice or deal with it, and it gets. That's what it does. That's what it does. It grows. It grows and grows and grows and grows. It picks up strength, and it gets great big goggly eyes, presumably. And then it did more than that. I can't remember the rest of it. Unfortunately, I couldn't rake up the rest of this song, but it goes around eating sheep and cows and bairns, I believe. It coils itself around the hill loads of times. It goes around eating sheep and cows and bairns, and when it gets thirsty, it milks a dozen cows. Basically, it lays waste to the countryside. I mean, there's Lord Lambton's estates, and it's terrorising, it's laying waste to them, it's eating the crops, it's eating the animals, it's eating the children, it's milking the cows, 12 at a time, and messing up the landscape by coiling itself around the hill, which today has got a monument on the top. So, if we don't admit or pay attention to the unskillful tendencies in ourselves, not only do they grow, they wreck our land. They ravage our inner world. They ravage our life. They grow to the point where they're really difficult to deal with. They lay things to waste. They consume our inner richness, the sheep and cows. They milk your cows. They make everybody's life a misery by eating their children. So here we have Lord Lambton off in the Holy Land, sorting out somebody else's problem, sorting out somebody else's land, making sure there's no evil there, dealing with what he sees as somebody else's unskillfulness, while his own land, his own world, is being wrecked by the results of his own unacknowledged unskillfulness, which he doesn't want to pay attention to. He wants it down the well, but it's not. It's off eating the bairns. This could be the politician campaigning for good causes and social justice while engaged in malicious cutthroat competition with his colleagues, massaging his expense account within the sort of normal legal limits, laying waste to the landscape of his family by the odd bit of unfaithfulness and lack of attention, but doing good for the world. This could be all sorts of people, couldn't it? It could be the worker in a charity who's terribly altruistic about the cause, but actually is acting from quite a lot of personal ambition, and it's mainly about getting on rather than doing good for the people you're supposed to be serving, or the activist who bitterly criticises the greed and ill will of the governments he hates, while ignoring the seething hate and malice which he feels about it himself, or even the person who's experiencing road rage because of everybody else's inconsiderate driving, when what they're doing is trying to get from A to B just as fast as everybody else, just like everybody else. So it's that tendency in ourselves not to look at what's going on in us, but to see it out there clear as daylight. But of course, I mean, the situation is so extreme in Lord Lambton's case that he can't carry on. His world is laid waste by the worm, his inner world and his life, and he can't ignore it anymore. So he has to stop sorting others out and sort himself out. So he gets the message, come back, come back, come back, there's a dragon, come back. There's a terrible world, this worm, this dragon, despoiling your lands, come back and deal with it. So he does, he doesn't have any choice really. So back home he goes at last to confront what would once have been something quite small and easy. I mean, when it was just a little thing, it was quite small and easy, but it's now grown to this awful size, and it's got great big teeth. In the song, his fight with the dragon is a bit unconvincing, really. It just says, it's all too easy. It's a bit of a light song. Maybe it's a drinking song. It's quite funny. He just kills the dragon. But in the story, it's not like that. In the story, it's not like that at all. It's not like that in life, either. Some tendency that's been ignored for years and years and has grown to dragon size isn't just easy meat. So in the legend, Lord Lambton realises he can't easily take on this dragon. If he confronts it head on, it's going to tear him into bits. So he consults a wise woman, a sort of witch. And she tells him exactly what he's got to do. She gives him the teaching as to how to kill this dragon. There's more to it than this, but the gist is that because the dragon is far stronger than him, and what it's going to do is it's going to wrap itself around him and squeeze him to death. And his own strength is enough to do anything with the dragon, so he's got to use the dragon's strength. He's got to use the dragon's strength to get rid of it. So she tells him that he must weld these really sharp blades onto his armour. And then when the dragon curls around him and tries to squeeze him, the dragon's own strength will cut the dragon into bits. So we might try and interpret that. We've got to use the dragon's strength against it, the worm's strength against it. So maybe if the worm was ill will and anger, maybe. Maybe he needs to use his ill will and anger against itself. Get terribly angry with this force which is destroying his world. Direct the force of anger against ill will itself, perhaps. We get this there's a Buddhist text called the Bodhicharya Avatara, which talks about doing this. It says, the only klesha I'm going to put up with is my desire to murder the kleshas. Klesha means disturbing negative mental state, things like ill will. So negative mental state. So the only klesha I'm going to put up with is my desire to murder the kleshas. It's like using ill will against ill will. He goes on in that particular text. It says, I don't care if my head drops off. I don't care if my guts spill out. I'm never going to surrender to my arch enemies, the kleshas. So it's a bit like using ill will, using a certain amount of aggression, even against the negative state. It's like turning the negative state against itself. Maybe that's what's being got at here. But I'm not going to pursue that at the moment. And nor am I going to pursue anything about the terrible curse that follows the Lambton family for generations afterwards. Except perhaps to say that, well, maybe even though he's dealt with the dragon, he's still got the karma to deal with, I don't know. But the main point is this, he's a self-centered person who's mainly out for himself and his own pleasure, and he doesn't want to see this or deal with his own unskillfulness, so he throws it down the well. But he sees the unskillfulness of others all too clearly and is very ready to go off and fight against their unskillfulness. And the result is that his own unskillfulness remains dealt with. He has not acknowledged his part in the world's evil. He has not acknowledged that he's part of the problem, just as everybody else. And his unskillfulness grows until it makes a complete mess of his land, symbolizing his inner world, his relationships, his life. His little bit of unskillfulness grows into this thing that causes huge unhappiness, which is big and difficult to deal with. And eventually, by the time he does deal with it, when he's forced to deal with it, it's difficult and dangerous, and it leaves a sort of blight, this curse on his family, which can't be undone. So this is a bit of a universal story, really, because this is what we humans do. In many ways, you know, this is almost a history of the human race. Human beings are very self-deluding. We are very self-deluding. I came across this... This is a model of human being. Okay. So this is our press officer, our PR agent, and this is the world out here, and this is us, evil genius. So we consist of an evil genius and a PR officer. This was somebody else's model. That we're thinking about ourselves. We're thinking in really cleverly about how to get what we want and not get what we don't want. But we've got a PR officer which stands up between us and the world, sort of presenting that as, well, I'm really rather good, actually. I mean, look at what I do, you know. And then we get fooled by our own PR officer. So we're taken in by our own PR. We don't want to think that there might be anything unskillful about our dearest, sweetest selves. We're just trying to organise the way that the world, the way we want it, that's all. Nothing wrong with that. The fact that it goes against everybody else trying to organise the world they want the way they want it, well, that's their fault, isn't it? I mean, it's not our fault. So we think we're all right and the problem is them. So what very often happens is we go to war with them. That's the most extreme thing we do. We go to war with them. We don't look at ourselves when in fact we are just the same as them. We're motivated by the same egocentricity, the same desires, the same ill will, the same fears. But we don't own up to the fact that we're part of the world's problem, that our greed and ill will is there. We project it. We see it in them, the bad guys. And as long as we do this, not only can't we deal with the problem in ourselves, we can't deal with it in ourselves because we're not admitting it's there, but we make it much worse by inventing enemies we can blame and go to war against or resent or stew in ill will about, just adding to our problems and everybody else's by sort of spreading this extra dose of ill will around. The thing about this is that we find, you know, this, we might find this really difficult to see in ourselves. It's easy to see in others. It's quite easy to see in others very often, but really difficult to see in ourselves. Because it really, we talk about the unconscious, but the unconscious really is unconscious. We don't know it's there. We don't know it. But it's almost a cliche. It's almost a sort of cliche of popular psychology that if somebody, if somebody really gets under our skin, really makes steam come out of our ears, and makes us fume, it's usually because we are a bit like them. Yeah? I'd invite you to consider this possibility, that when we really get stewed up about something, it's because we're a bit like them. So we see the stuff we're not acknowledging in ourselves in them. If we're a bit arrogant, but we aren't owning up to it, then arrogance in others is just unsupportable. If we're a bit dishonest, but we're not owning up to it, dishonest politicians just make us grind our teeth. If we're a bit intolerant, but we're not seeing this, then intolerance is so infuriating we'd like to just get them and put them in jail, you know. Because after, and it's funny, isn't it? Why do we get so annoyed about some things? Because if we look around the world, if we look at human beings, we can see a vast and wonderful spectrum of flaws and foibles and strange characteristics and weaknesses in our fellow humans, and in us. That's what we unenlightened human beings are like. We're very, very imperfect. And most of this rich spectrum of human fallibility and silliness doesn't bother us at all. Most of the time we accept people for what they are. Sometimes we've got faults that we know we've got and they've got. We see them, they share them with us. And that doesn't bother us at all. We might even indulge them together. Go out and sort of join up on the basis of those faults. And sometimes they've got faults that we haven't got, and we might look down on them a bit or feel a bit superior, but we don't get furious about it. We don't get furious about that. But when somebody's got something that's like us that we're not acknowledging, that's when we really get hot under the collar. That's when we can spot it. Out of all that spectrum, there's just those ones that really get us going, because we're a bit like that. We are a bit like that. We either do that behaviour ourselves, or we would like to do that behaviour if we could get away with it, if we were powerful enough, if we were good-looking enough, if we were rich enough, or if we just had the courage, we would do that. And I mean, it might help us to see that if we sort of consider two extremes of humanity. So we might consider an enlightened being at one end. So an enlightened being really not having any faults, or very few, an enlightened being really sorted out, or a very developed person, very sorted out. And they would look at the world and they would see people with all their faults and foibles. But the response wouldn't be to get furious and stewed up about them. It would be compassion. It would be a desire to help. It would be a desire to help people get out of their unskillfulness. So that's one extreme. Somebody who's got very little they need to work on, who would be seeing the world, seeing others' foibles without anger or without blame, but a desire to help. And then we get the opposite extreme, which we might see around us. Somebody who's got lots of unskillful tendencies, but is constantly criticizing and resenting others. It's almost like there's a correlation. The more unskillful tendencies that are not being dealt with, the more criticism, resentment, complaining. So where do we fit? We might ask ourselves where we fit in that spectrum. How critical am I? How much energy do I put into blaming and complaining about others and so on? So am I off fighting a crusade while my land is being despoiled by a dragon I'm not dealing with? So really our first job, evil genius, our first job in this integration is to start seeing ourselves a bit more truly, maybe a bit more as others see us. It's very easy to see in others this stuff, but it's really difficult in us. It is unconscious. We don't know it. The worm really is down the well where it can't be seen. So how do we get it out? How do we get the worm out of the well before it grows into a dragon? I suppose that's the question. Well, one way is to sort of enroll others. We see each other actually much more accurately than we see ourselves very, very often. We see things about other people. Yeah, it's plain as the nose on your face. But for ourselves, it really is down the well. So one is to enroll others, isn't it? That's part of the sort of ideal of Sangha, if you like, that we develop the sorts of friendships, the sort of close, trusting, but very frank friendships that allow ourselves to, that allow us to really allow us to have others tell us what they see about us, and take that and act on it, so that we don't see ourselves just through our eyes, we see ourselves through others' eyes. We're willing to take feedback, etc. So that sounds great, doesn't it? It sounds wonderful. So our friends are going to tell us what we should be working on, and then we'll get an all-round picture of ourselves, and yeah, in your dreams. I mean, that is such an advanced practice, actually, to really take criticism from others. and requires such trust that, okay, it would be great, isn't it? I mean, it's a good thing to aim for, but it's really difficult. There's a few other things we could do, couldn't we? One is we could watch out for our pet hates. We could watch out for the things that really steam us up. And then we could ask ourselves, honestly, might I ever do something like that? Might I ever do that myself, or might I want to do that myself? That would be one way. Could it be possible that I exhibit this tendency? If we ask ourselves that, well, we might often, if we're really honest, just have to say, I don't know about you. I mean, one of the things that I remember something about me. This is a really minor little confession, but you're sitting in a dual carriageway. And it's blocked. There's one lane going through. And what most of the law-abiding citizens do is they very early on all get into that one lane and queue up in a nice orderly manner, and we all think, yes, we're good citizens. And then somebody, usually in a four-wheel drive or a really expensive car, goes sailing down the outside and gets in at the front. And my steam goes, why is how dare they? Who do they think they are? I'd love to do it. I've done it. And by heck is it annoying, you know, when I'm saying no, I'm going to be a good citizen. The people who do it, I rapidly string. It's not first degree homicide. You know, there are even signs telling you to do it because it reduces the length of the queue if people use both lanes and then filter in. By heck, see, that's just a little example of how, you know, the things that really get our goat tend to be the things we do or want to do. So watching out for those things, ask oneself, honestly, do I exhibit that tendency? Do I do that myself? And another one, I think something, yeah, the metta bhavana, the fourth stage of the metta bhavana, looking who we put in the fourth stage of the metta bhavana. So we usually think of the metta bhavana as a practice for developing positive emotion. But I think it's also a really good practice for developing integration. Who do we put in the fourth stage and why? Because in the fourth stage of the metta bhavana, yes, it's about forgiving somebody else. It's about forgiving somebody else and developing metta for somebody else. But very often, it's also about forgiving ourselves for being like that person and developing metta for ourselves. It's about forgiving ourselves and developing metta for ourselves in a way that allows us to, if we forgive that person, it's almost as though we sort of reintegrate a bit of ourselves. That person, the view we have of that person is very often a bit of ourselves that we've just gone over there, it's bad, it's him. But we can bring it back in. We can see that it's part of ourselves. We can forgive it. We can forgive ourselves. And part of doing that, of course, is that what we do is we have this self-description, and then we sort of think that everything outside that self-description is wrong and bad, and we don't own up to it at all. But parts of the stuff that we don't allow ourselves to think we are is okay. Actually, maybe it's okay to cruise up the outside of the dual carriage. If everybody did that, the queues wouldn't be as long, would they? So maybe I should allow myself to do it. Hey, maybe it's not wrong, you know. So that's one of the things that happens, is we see, well, maybe that's not, you know, that's a stupid example, but a certain amount of aggression, for example. I mean, sometimes people, you know, we just sort of sit on our, you know, I have no anger. There's nobody in the world I don't like. Grrr, but actually we're stewing. But maybe we've got some aggression, which is, you know, quite healthy in a way. It's just sort of healthy self-assertion. Which is coming out in a quite negative way. But we can't find this out as long as we're just always projecting all the stuff we don't want to own up to out there. So this is about sort of owning up to the stuff that we need to work on. Seeing that there is unskillfulness in us. But this is a little bit of a minefield, isn't it? Because we don't want to get into beating ourselves up. We don't want to get into, I'm a miserable sinner, pass me the whip. So how do we do it? How do we really open up to the fact that there is unskillful stuff we need to work on, without which we're not going anywhere? Unless we work on it, we're not going anywhere. Without getting into guilt, beating ourselves up, having a really negative self-view, etc., etc. I think one is to... for me anyway, the key is to get beyond the idea that I am like this. It's that use of the word I am this sort of person. I am an irritable person. I am an angry person. I am a dishonest person. That's a description about somehow it's fundamentally part of me to be like that. And as long as we think that it's fundamentally part of me, if it's fundamentally me to be a particular way, that I really don't like, well, I'm going to have a really hard job owning up to that, because it's tantamount to saying I'm no good, I'm horrible. So I think it's got something to do with moving from saying I am a greedy person to saying something more like, or thinking something more like, well, under certain circumstances, I exhibit greedy tendencies. It's like saying I have got into some habits. It's not like I am an irritable person or I am a stingy person. It's that, well, irritability and stinginess are habits that sort of come out under certain circumstances. Habits I've got into because of circumstances and habits I can get out of. Yeah? It's as though we need some sort of basis for self-esteem. We need to relate less to our negative tendencies, not identify with our negative tendencies. Identify more with our potential. And that allows us to sort of see that we're not them. We're not defined by our negative tendencies. We can deal with them. We don't have to deny them, because they're not sort of intrinsic to us. They're things we can regret, even feel remorse for, without sort of feeling crippled by guilt about, because they're not intrinsic to us. We've got somewhere to stand which is above and beyond them, which is, if you like, our potential, what we could be, our spiritual potential. So seeing when they do, don't they? Really horrible, stingy thoughts come up, or really horrible, hateful thoughts come up. They just do. If we'd got this loudspeaker on top of our head, it would be like, oh my God! That blasting out to everybody. But seeing it's not me. Those thoughts will come up. They can be the product of my past in all sorts of ways. But I don't have to identify with it. I don't have to think, that's me. I can think, well, that is what my brain is doing. That's what my mind is doing. And I can disidentify it, stand back from it, and desire and not put energy into it. And then start to get out of the habit of it. So if we can do that, if we can sort of see that, sort of take the sort of attitude that sees our mental weather and our past habits as habits that we've got into, rather than intrinsic to us, and really look at them a bit more objectively, then maybe we can really start to accept where we are. Then we could start where we are. In Pema Chodron's terms. And if we start where we are, we might really get somewhere. But if we don't, we're not. So maybe that's the story. Maybe that's the sort of moral of the Lambton Worm.